All right, what's up, everybody? We're back again with another episode of the Body Lock Podcast. We're up to episode 23, and we're going to be talking about UFC 222 today. Cyborg won the main event, as we all expected. In the co-main event, Brian Ortega shocked everyone watching with just the way he won that one. And the rest of the main card, it was a little bit lackluster in some ways, but there was a fight of the night between Andre Sukumtat and Sean O'Malley. We're going to be discussing all of these fights and the prelims, a couple of those ones as well today. So let's get started. I'm Jake Nichols. I'm here with Nicholas Vera and Sirius Brown. Let's flick over to Nick. How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. You know, as a Jersey native, I'm still in a state of mourning, but I'm pushing through the day. You know, I'm still trying to be productive, and I got a letter from the library, actually, and some books are overdue, so. And I didn't know, so I got to figure some shit out. But other than that, it's
What do you got to figure out? How long are they overdue? Like, are we looking at
like a good month? So, and I honestly, I forgot just in the process of school and everything going on. It's like I forgot that I even had books checked out, and I checked, and I didn't get any emails. So I don't know. Maybe it's their bad. I'm gonna try to figure something out. But I mean, other than that, it's been a so-so day, I guess.
And it's been so-so as well. I thought that pay-per-view was a really bad one. And if not for Ortega executing Frankie Edgar on live television, it would have been one of the worst in recent memory. Apparently, I have ringworm, but I got Lotrimin, so whatever, right?
What?
What? Other than that, I got in silver 5 on League. Didn't I mean, I'm pretty bad, so that was... That was unexpected. So, yeah, you know, the goods and the bads.
Okay, well, there's some... we're bringing you obviously the most important news here today on the Body Lock Podcast, as always. There's nothing that is probably irrelevant. That doesn't really happen here. So, let's jump into the main event really quickly. I know we want to talk about the co-main event more than anything else here, but let's give some credit where it's due into the scheduling of the UFC event, and that was... a main event matchup between Chris Cyborg and Yana Kuniskaya. Obviously, Kuniskaya was coming in and making her UFC debut, and look, she was moving up a weight division here to take on Cyborg in the 145-pound weight class. Yeah, I was impressed with the way she does it. She hits hard, but we saw a little bit of Chris Cyborg that we hadn't seen before. What did you guys think of this one?
You know, I was a little bit depressed coming out of this one just because I had a weird feeling that, you know, something was going to give for Yana. Maybe I wasn't expecting her to win. Obviously it was just more of like, I wanted to see something, redeeming from her, you know, something that could, really, you know, make her, I guess, stand out, you know, for the future. And not to say that she didn't do anything well, that's not what I'm saying at all, but it just kind of felt the second that she, felt Cyborg's power, it was just an immediate kind of, you saw her kind of crawl back into her shell, and that was really tough to watch. You know, you don't want to see a fighter go through that, at least like it, that hard in their UFC debut. It was kind of unsettling, you know, that, you know, it's a testament to what Cyborg can do in the cage. Obviously, you know, she's young, she's still a prospect, but by any means, and you know, her track record before coming into the UFC was special, and she's had wins over notable names. So it's not like the end of the world, but, just, you know, with the pacing of that card up until then with the two fights prior, I thought it was just not the best matchup. But again, you know, the main event was supposed to be something else entirely. So there's not much to complain about. Cyborg is a beast for doing what she does and coming in on short notice. And we have to appreciate her for that. And I'm just looking forward to the Amanda Nunes fight.
Yeah, there's nothing unexpected for me. I just... the moment I heard, you know, that Cyborg wasn't going to be fighting an actual featherweight, it's like, oh, yeah, Kunitskaya, she's coming up from bantamweight, you know, and she's really taking on a challenge. I was like, well, then you've told me all I need to know about this fight. You know, when if there was a room and on the door it said challengers at 145 and you opened the door, you'd find a bunch of 135-pounders and a lot of pies. That's really what it is. We need to find an actual featherweight to step up and fight Cyborg because she's way, way too strong for people to try to step up against step up and wait against her right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The only other featherweight that's out there that really even is considering the option of stepping in there with Cyborg is Megan Anderson, and she did call her out on Instagram. I guess, like, but then again, if Megan Anderson does come into the UFC, we get another person coming in and making their UFC debut against Chris Cyborg, and it's just not good for the division in any way whatsoever, I think. All these people are coming in and testing themselves against the champion, and everyone's losing. We all expect them to lose. Chris Cyborg's unreal. We have to give credit where it's due there, but the Amanda Nunes matchup is the one that I want to see. That I really want to see someone come in there and challenge Cyborg, because I don't know how many people are going to keep buying main events where Cyborg's the headlining and just rolling people.
I mean, she definitely has the fan base. she carries an aura about her that deserves, you know, a great level of respect and adoration, which she does have. I just think there needs to be more, you know, classic matchups. You know, Anthony Joshua is a beast, but he's only so good if he doesn't have the matchups that make him that much more special. So I think once Cyborg has three or four of those under her belt, she can, you know, ride off into the sunset. But I just think with where she's at in her career, there's still more to be had, and Amanda Nunes is that definitive first step. So, yeah, I'm excited for the future. It's going to be a big year for sure for her.
All right, and I guess there's not much to really say about this fight. That's just kind of how it played out. Let's jump into the one that we really want to discuss. And I think this is the moment that is ingrained in everybody's minds right now after this event. It's absolutely spectacular. Brian Ortega defeated Frankie Edgar while standing up. I mean, he defeated Cub Swanson while standing up, but that's a different type of standing up. He submitted him by...
Sunk in the guillotine standing up.
So he's done it once again, but this time with strikes. And it was nasty, too. I didn't really expect this as an outcome. I don't think anyone did. Let's jump in with you, Sirius, first of all. What did you think of this one, and what was your take coming out of this?
I mean, it goes without saying, I did not see it coming. You know, just like... I'm reminded of when Robert Whittaker knocked out Jacare Souza, like out of nowhere, someone has gone from becoming on the cusp of being elite and actually people should care about them to, oh my God, this might genuinely be the best guy in the division. Now, Max Holloway essentially cleaned out the division before him, so I wouldn't go that far. But now, I think, really, really think about it, and I don't know what it takes to beat Ortega. Because hitting and running, Frankie was hitting and running him fine. Even Cub was in those first round, just sinking in those quick shots, body head coming out. Ortega caught Frankie with one elbow, and that was all it took. He intercepted him once, you know? And what Ortega standing up, his guard is just good enough that he's not going to eat a clean shot to somewhere that's going to put him out. He's not going to eat a huge liver shot. He's not going to take one right on the chin. So he can... And he has a good enough chin that he can just let people flurry against him, so to speak, and pick his shots. If Frankie can't go in and out against him, that doesn't bode well. Because I think if Max Holloway can't do it, then I think Ortega will essentially rule this division. Like, that was an incredible performance.
Yeah, 100% agreed. I think top to bottom, Ortega proved that he's the complete package. And we didn't even see his ground game in this fight, but we know what he's capable of in fights prior. I think what really turned the tide in this fight, in terms of, you know, Frankie was, you know, fighting at his own pace, trying to get the combinations, moving in and out, applying his footwork. But what really changed the fight was when Ortega landed that switch kick, you know, like he fakes the left and switches in midair to the right, and then he hit him in the body, and then all of a sudden something changed with Frankie, and Frankie was trying to throw a straight, he'd get caught with a jab. And just from that point on, Ortega had him with his timing, and you could just see the damage was accumulating. He hits that elbow, catches him with the uppercut, and the rest is history. I mean, he really just – talk about assessing your opponent and kind of – you know, he said to himself, he waits for the fight and makes those in-game adjustments, and you could see him, you know, there was the feeling out process. He saw what he was about. He landed, and when he landed, he kept on landing. And you know, it says something about Frankie Edgar when he hasn't been taken out like that at all at any point in his career. And Ortega just does it in emphatic fashion where, I mean, you start to question how powerful is Ortega and can Max Holloway match up with that, you know? And this is really, you know, coming into this next fight, which would be for the title, there's so many ways to look at it. I think it's the fight that defines a new era in the UFC. And I mean, Max Holloway was already talking about UFC 226. And I think this gave it the ultimate green light. There's, you know, two colliding forces, two differing schools of thought. They do pretty much the same thing, but they have their nuances. And, you know, Max Holloway has his perks with his endurance and the ability to, you know, when fight and see red and keep fighting. And Ortega is the same thing. I think they're very similar, but just different enough to make it a really compelling matchup. And I think this changes things. This really does change things. It changed things in the UFC, and it's just that. It's the beginning of a new era.
Yeah, I definitely feel that.
Question: do you think Frankie is? Do you think Frankie was always on the downswing of his career, and it took Ortega to show us that? Or do you think Ortega did something genuinely, like, otherworldly? Because we've never seen that happen to Frankie before. But what we've seen him take, just the two title fights against Gray Maynard alone, just abhorrent amounts of damage. Benson Henderson concussed him, I think, with an upkick when he won the title from him. I think plenty of people have gotten their licks in. And I don't know, do you think this is just kind of the final tick on the odometer in his brain? Or do you think Ortega really is just, he's out there?
My take on this, I think that Edgar isn't declining whatsoever. I think he looked pretty good. He was doing all the right things. But man, this matchup was terrible for him. And I'm going to say it's just because his game, once he gets on the inside, he would generally look for maybe a takedown attempt and take someone down or really start to grapple with someone. But with Brian Ortega, you don't want to do that. So what Edgar kept on doing, he kept running forward with his combos and he was landing clean. But then when he got inside boxing range of Ortega, unlike many other people, actually stood there and didn't care. Like, it's like, come on, man, come stand close to me and, you know, let's trade shots, because I'm not in any way scared of your takedown. I'm going to counter you on the ground and probably submit you. So I don't see that Edgar is declining by any chance, but I think it's a really rough matchup for him in hindsight. And look, again, no one really saw this coming, but Ortega is fearless. He doesn't need to worry about that takedown. And I think all I'm trying to say is that it's a really bad matchup for him. That's what I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. The matchup was bad, and Ortega is that good. I mean, Edgar's only lost one fight since 2013 to Jose Aldo before this one. And, you know, he's beaten a variety of names in different weight classes. I think this was the twilight of his career. You know, this is the beginning of the end for Edgar. But he definitely, at this point where he was last night, he definitely was not approaching that. And it's just a testament to how good, how dangerous Brian Ortega is. And once again, I mean, he was a rising star before this, and now he's a phenom. And I think he's really putting himself in that position to be the next big star. And yeah, I mean, and it says something about this event too, how many young fighters were able to make the upsets and establish a name. You know, I think that top to bottom, this was one of the cards for, you know, we might be looking back in 20 or so pay-per-views and be like, wow, like, you know, there was a lot of potential that grew from this.
The thing that kind of sucks as an outcome of this is that only one of Brian Ortega and Max Holloway can be a champion. Because I think, like, in my eyes, I'd like to see them both as a champion, because Brian Ortega is quickly becoming a star. And, well, I hope he does. Anyway, that's all for me in this co-main event. So let's jump in and talk about the one before this, and I'm going to have to leave a disclaimer here at the very beginning of this, because as you guys know, we had Andre Sukumtat on the podcast last week. He's a friend of the Body Locks. We're all big fans. I know that he's going to come back very strong. That was his first fight in a new 5-fight contract. He's going to bounce back, and I hope he does later this year in a very big way, because I'm going to come out and say, but that was some of the worst decision-making I've ever seen inside the UFC's octagon in round three. There's no doubt about it. I couldn't believe what was happening. I was getting so frustrated. Sean O'Malley had injured himself really, really badly. He was hopping around on one leg. And Sukumtat decided to take him down to the mat for the last 3 minutes. And I kept failing with guillotine attempts. And I couldn't really see what the plan was. I don't know. I was... So there are two outcomes of this fight to me. And one was that Sean O'Malley looked really, really good. His creative striking is next level. I'm never going to doubt this guy again, I don't think. I didn't think he was quite on the level of Sukumtat before this fight, but man, was I proven wrong. He looked outstanding. The second one was Sukumtat really had no path to victory at the start of the third round. I turned to everyone in my room and I said, I don't see a way that he can win this. Sean O'Malley was winning on the feet. And Sukumtat was really struggling on the ground. I think that's one of the major issues to come out of this. And then halfway through the round, he was presented with a key to victory and didn't take it. So, yeah, a strange, strange, strange fight. But what did you guys think about this one? And Nick, I'll lead with you.
All right, here's my theory on how that played out. And again, I haven't talked to him. I don't know this for a fact. This is just my hunch as to why he did the things he did in that third round. I remember distinctly in the first round, Sukumtat hurt his ankle. I can't remember which foot it was, but he hurt his foot in a way that I could see him wincing. It was after one of those nasty leg kicks that O'Malley laid into him. So when he was going down to the ground reflexively, because he could see that O'Malley was an easy target to take down, I think that was also for his well-being, more so than it was to, you know, that was the route that he wanted to take to finish O'Malley, just because, you know, you don't know exactly what, you know, another three more minutes on that foot would do, and, you know, if he wanted to throw a kick and if it would land weird. I don't know. I just think maybe to cut out the variables of further injury, he was just trying to, you know, force the fight a certain way, and then he was really leaning towards a guillotine but couldn't find it. I think maybe that's why things panned out the way they did. And again, I'm just speaking purely out of what I saw in the fight and maybe what could have happened. You know, I try to, like, put myself in the position of you know, why did the fighter do what he did? And I think that's what it could have been, you know, related to the injury. And I don't know, I saw Sukumtat walking fine, so it could have just been, like, you know, the pain that he was feeling at the moment, and then it kind of, you know, once everything passed over, it was okay, or at least, you know, in better condition than O'Malley. But I think that's kind of what happened there. And again, a lot of people were giving him flack, like, you know, people were, like, calling him just a straight up, like, a stupid fighter on Twitter. And I was like, all right, let's not push it to that extent. I mean, it was, you know, it's a chess match when you're going against O'Malley. You can't just sit there and you know, take your time to pick your shots or find something, even if he's on one leg. Because, again, he also has really good ground game. I mean, he's been working on his wrestling. And that's what I will say about this for O'Malley. You know, his growth exponentially fight to fight has been insane. I mean, it's really been something fun to watch. And he's been saying that he's developing a lot in his wrestling and grappling, and we haven't been able to see it. I saw it last night. I think at least defensively on one leg, he was doing things that was just, you know, in the spur of the moment, really smart. And he was able to withstand everything that Sukumtat was trying to do. And again, I think that's a testament to his will. And I mean, the dude had the first floor interview in UFC history. I mean, come on, like, that was something special. I mean, he's a really fun fighter to watch, and I can't wait to continue watching his growth. He's great, and I hope we get him on the podcast.
Now that you defend Andre's decision making, I kind of do see what you're saying. Like, because before, and I'm allowed to make this joke because Andre is also of Asian descent. Like, when I saw his decision making in that fight, I was like, if that was my child, I would beat him, you know? But and Andre knows it comes from a place of love because we had Asian parents, okay? Shout out to mom and dad. But now that you say that, yeah, because, man, Sugar, he's the worst person to have low mobility against, especially when he's fresh. He's gonna light you up. You can't go anywhere. You know, so I guess, like, finally thinking, oh, yes, he can't do anything. I can get him to the ground and I can at least win this round for sure. right, I understand that. I think he's looked better. Sean O'Malley's looked better in his short career, his short UFC stint, obviously. We have yet to see him really tested, and by that I mean he's a rangy freak athlete with just creative and brave. Because if you're not losing, you have no reason to you have nothing to fear. You know what I mean? So he throws with reckless abandon because the consequences don't exist for him yet. Who's the person that maybe catches one of his kicks, takes him down, and can actually hold him down? Even if it doesn't beat him, maybe rides out 2-1 against him and he can't do anything. You know, there are plenty of people like that. So I think he's really good. I do want to see him against one of, not the top guys, obviously, but he's working his way up. You know, I want to see someone that we would regard as a complete fighter and see how he does. But otherwise, nah, fun to watch.
Dare I say it? But Sean O'Malley's style reminds me of a certain someone.
Hold on. No. Nick and I each get one guess. Nick, you first.
Conor McGregor.
If that's it, I'm not going to guess. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Seriously. You watch this guy, and everything about the way he fights is like he's modeling his game off watching Conor McGregor. It's not a bad thing to do. We just haven't seen it happen yet because no one's young enough to come through the system watching Conor McGregor. Normally, it's guys watching GSP and those ones trying to model off the older fighters. But Conor McGregor is a whole new one. And Sean O'Malley is using all these different techniques to manipulate the timing and pace of the fight. I think that's why he can throw with reckless abandon, as you said, Sirius, because he's controlling the fight. He's controlling every aspect of it. And Sukumtat had major difficulty in trying to even come close to striking O'Malley. He really had no answer for any of his stand-up pacing. He controlled every aspect of it. It's quite amazing. Nick, I wanted to touch on some of the things you said. I think everyone kind of forgot about that kick that obviously hurt Sukumtat in the first round. It striked me as something that was very similar to the Romero versus Whittaker fight, where I thought he was going to have to carry that throughout the rest of the fight. But in the second and third round, it seemed like he had kind of healed, but then again, Whittaker seemed like he had kind of healed through those last stages of that fight as well. It's hard to tell. But I also want to touch on some of the other theories, I guess, because that's all we have of why Sukumtat decided to take him down. And something that other people are forgetting is that at the end of the first round, he was rocked really badly. I think he was unconscious.
He walked in a circle. And it wasn't even he wanted to walk in a circle. He didn't have the balance. It was crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. At the time, I couldn't tell if that was because of the leg. But I think it was mainly because of the heavy strikes that O'Malley landed. And I think I wouldn't have had a problem if the fight had been stopped there because you could tell that he wasn't quite in the game. All I'm trying to say is that he had to fight two more rounds after that first experience. And imagine forgetting what's happened. By the end of the fight, Sukumtat had his hand raised because he thought he'd won the fight. And I think that maybe that what had happened at the end of the first round had an effect on him that lasted. And it's quite sad because, I don't know, you don't really know the effects of some of the... Well, you don't know the impact of what's happening inside the octagon sometimes. And that could be a good example. But, man, I couldn't... You know what's amazing? If he hadn't have taken him down, the O'Malley train could have been stopped already. And, does that make sense? O'Malley could go on a run of, 3 or 4 wins and storm up the rankings, much like Conor McGregor did. But if Sukumtat had stood there with him, he could have stopped it already. To me, that reminds me of when Mendes came up against McGregor. If Mendes had won that fight, what would have Conor McGregor turned into? He would have taken a completely different path.
Yep.
That's why replay that fight. And with Chad Mendes having a full camp, and I think we're in a completely different world in MMA.
Yeah, no, I agree.
That's where I'm getting. Imagine if Sukumtat had kept him standing. I think the doctors would have called the fight off because he was hopping. But enough of talking about this. I want to give some massive respect to O'Malley. I think this guy is a weapon. He's going to rise to famous, or everyone seems to really enjoy watching him. He's got that swagger about him. I think he's going to go places, and I can't wait to see where he goes next.
And about the Conor, mimicking, there's definitely that influence, but I think in some ways he's cleaner. You know, he's more more ambitious than Conor really ever was with some of the kicks. And I remember thinking that, like, when I'd watch it, before I saw Conor fight fully, I saw, you know, Conor's highlight reels, and then you see all this spinning stuff. And then when, you know, in the real fights that he's had after Seaver, that's very rarely a route that he goes, because, you know, he just relies so much on his boxing. Obviously it gets the job done, so there's no knock on that. But when you're talking about spinning shit, just wow factor in his fighting, I thought O'Malley showed a full display in that first round. Like, he had so many great combinations, and I really like, you know, he would throw a spin and fake a kick just to get that read on what Sukumtat would do, and then follow it up again, you know, off of another feint, you know, just the way he sequenced things in his stand up, and it was just something out of this world. And I think it's something that we can all get used to, you know, going forward, because the train hasn't stopped rolling, and I don't want it to stop. So, yeah, let's get into the
choo-choo.
And Andre, choo-choo. You're still our boy.
Right, for sure.
100%. Forget it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see him come back and prove everyone wrong, because I know that he's at the end of a relentless barrage of online assault right now. I don't know if that's even a proper sentence, but it kind of works.
Yeah, I got it.
It's quite ugly to see, but I hope he bounces back strong. So let's jump into the fight before this, and it's one that I could easily forget if I wanted to, because it was Andrei Arlovsky versus Stefan Struve, and boy, was this an absolute stinker, I thought. The fight itself really offered nothing entertaining. I think everyone watching this was hoping for a stoppage, because the night had lacked that kind of impact so far. Nothing had really happened up until this fight, and we were all expecting maybe to see a big knockout in the first round, potentially. Instead, we saw Arlovsky come in with a new and improved game plan. He looks to be a new fighter, dare I say that, but he ended up with 4 takedowns yesterday at UFC 222, and I think before that, he'd only had 3 takedowns in his career, so that's a bit strange, very strange indeed. Stefan Struve, obviously the same problems are still there for him, but this fight was riddled with fouls and problems, eye pokes, everything was going wrong, the pacing of the fight sucked, there was breaks in between. I'm so glad that the next 3 fights after that delivered in a way, because boy, was this getting quite ugly.
It's hard to watch Arlovsky like this. He's one of the dudes I didn't grow up watching him, because I got into MMA fairly late, but like in old UFC heavyweight highlights, Arlovsky is a mainstay for a reason. And I remember Barnett hinted at this, that Arlovsky was learning how to subtly foul him, because, you know, he's a veteran. He's not as fast as he used to be. But Barnett's also a vet of the game, so he like cheekily like gave him props for that. But man, he can't knock people out. He's not really putting on exciting fights anymore. He barely won against Frank Mir. That Frank Mir fight was like even worse, in my opinion. You know, I love Mir, I love Arlovsky. That fight was terrible. Struve, on the other hand, I'm so amazed that Struve lost this fight. I thought Junior Albini and his supersonic diaper shorts should have knocked Arlovsky into next year. And somehow that didn't happen. And I was like, okay, well, Struve, you know, wears big boy pull-ups. Struve can do what Albini cannot. And he did. It's not like Arlovsky outboxed him, but Struve literally couldn't land on him. I'm more disappointed in Struve than Arlovsky after that. Like, after that loss, I don't know what's next for Struve. I don't know how he's supposed to survive in this division. I mean, am I the only one feeling like that?
No, you're not, because there's a whole new range of talent coming through the division. We have to remember, like, someone like Tai Tuivasa is coming through, and that guy can hit so hard, and he's going to walk forward fearlessly. I don't think Struve can handle someone like him right now, so... And Tuivasa just hit rank 15. I think,
ooh,
where does he go from there? You're right. I actually don't know. And also, Arlovsky, who was on a firefight winning streak, has now won 2 in a row. And I think that, let's not forget, though, that firefight winning streak was against the very best in the division. And now he's fighting some guys outside of the top 5 and getting wins. So maybe he wasn't that bad after all. Like, because it looked like he was doing terribly for a moment there. But it's really, It's almost pointless really thinking about these two guys right now. I don't want to say that, but it kind of is.
Yeah. Man, that's sad. Because what?
It is sad.
Struve's been in the UFC for a decade now, I think.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think he still brings that entertainment factor. And I'll give him that because I was watching with some guys who were watching their first well, not first, but like rarely ever watch UFC.
Yeah,
and
they
saw Stefan Struve inside the cage and they're like, what is this guy? Like, he's monstrous. He's like towering above everybody in there. And if only he could get it going, but man, this feels like a conversation we could have been having like 8 years ago now. And I think everyone's sick of hearing it.
And like, I wrote about this, but Struve's career, he doesn't have much longer. He suffered 6 knockout losses in the UFC, and these are heavyweight knockouts, okay? That's knockouts with whipped cream and chopped nuts on top. Like, that's the kind of stuff that your entire family tree remembers, you know what I mean? And he suffered that 6 times. I mean, whenever there's a top flight heavyweight fighting on a card in the past few years, they always have a highlight of them putting Struve out. They do. Alistair Overeem has one. Junior Dos Santos has one. Mark Hunt has one. Volkov has one now. I'm sure I'm missing someone. Roy Nelson isn't one of the best, and he has one. I know it's terrible, but I think Struve maybe should consider hanging it up. Especially after this loss, like you said, there's nowhere else to go for him. You know, and I don't want to see him beating up scrubs, you know, he's too good for that. So I don't know what's next. I mean, I like the guy. He's a likable guy, but
could be the end. Maybe. No, we'll see what happens. But
no, yeah, it's really tough to say because like you said, when you see him and you're not really that familiar with the UFC or MMA, you're just like, wow, what is this dude? He's taller than the octagon. And and he just always not always finds ways to lose. It's just that there's been a lot of not realizing his potential over the years, and I think it's really caught up to him at this point. And with this loss to Orlovsky, and again, it could be, you know, that just the trauma that he's felt in certain fights affecting him, you know, moving forward or something along those lines. Again, I don't want to, you know, delve too much into that. I have no knowledge of that, but it's definitely not something that is improving, and. Yeah, it's tough to go up from here with guys like Taito Iwasa laying in the wake. You know, there's not a lot of traction, you know. But yeah.
On a more positive note, in the first bout of the main card, we had Ketlen Vieira, who came in and got over the line against Kat Zingano. And this, like, we're talking about some guys fading also in the other divisions, but Ketlen Vieira is like a breath of fresh air in the women's bantamweight division. She is now 10-0. She is so strong in there and really just bullied Zingano through those first two rounds before giving up the last one, really just cruising the victory, I guess. But she's now, I think, 4-0 in the UFC since she arrived in 2016. She's picked up wins over Sarah McMahon and Kat Zingano, respectively, in a row now. And look, Zingano returned. She looked very confident, but man, like they're she just looks so, I don't know how to say this, but look like the game has outgrown her. That's what I really want to say because her striking looked horrible. She was like launching out straight punches and they were coming back to her hips. I think she just looks bad right now because everyone else is starting to look a lot better, the way that mixed martial arts have improved in recent years. But before I jump in, what's with the random split decision in this one? I thought that Vieira obviously controlled the fight and somehow one judge gave it to Zingano.
Yeah, definitely should be called into question. I have to agree with you there. I thought Mackenzie Dern showed some questionable stand-up and then Kat Zingano came out and really just kind of redefined.
It was a hold my beer moment.
Yeah, and I was upset at that, honestly, because Kat Zingano was talking so highly of herself in her MMA Junkie interview, and I was really upbeat. I was looking at this fight as a form of redemption for her, and I think it was just she just wanted it so bad that she was willing to, you know, throw her chin out there just to like land that, you know, picture perfect knockout punch. But Vieira proved she was tougher, she proved she was smarter, and she proved that she was more durable, and overall it was just a lackluster night for Zingano. And I think, it could be a symptom of the game is passing her by, or maybe she's, getting too into her own mind in the cage. You know, she wants things to be a certain way. Maybe she's trying to she's forcing things to a certain extent and ends up closing things off in other ways for her, I don't know. It definitely doesn't look like she's learning from the losses that she's had since Ronda Rousey. And she went from one of the undefeated prospects to 0-3 in her last three outings. And it's few and far between. I think her last fight was UFC 200. Is there a reason for that length of time that she was out? I can't remember exactly. I don't know.
I think she was facing injuries, I think.
Yeah, it could have just been a suit. And you know, that also plays a factor into, how confident you are with your own body coming back from a number of injuries. You never know.
Oh yeah, you don't sign the dotted line to get, punched in the face after 2 years away from the sport and go in full 100%. You gotta shake the rust off.
For sure.
But I don't have much invested in Kat Zingano. I will say this. Her last three losses are to Ronda Rousey, who, man, she went in that with just a terrible game plan.
That decision-making's up there with Andre Sukumtat.
Wow, let's not say that.
Wow.
It's up there with Okami deciding to pull half guard against OSP. We'll say that.
Oh, that's a bad memory.
Shout out to our very first podcast ever, by the way. half guard on purpose. Juliana Pena really, really upped her game, and what she's ranked either two or three in the division right now with good reason, I think. And Vieira looked really good. I think it's a case like what happened to Dan Hardy, and to a lesser extent, or no, to a greater extent, what happened to Michael Johnson. Where they're really good, and then they're just like, you're really good, and they're kind of good, so let's just fight and see what happens. And did that three times in a row without realizing that the prospects that they were facing would go on to become some of the best in the division. I still think Zingano's striking did look pretty bad, but I don't think... I think this is an 0-3 with an asterisk. I think she can come back and at least be competitive in this division. I don't think that'll be a problem.
Yeah, I'd like to see her come back again and have another crack at it, because obviously her mental state's there. I think that's more important than the physical state at times, because if you're mentally prepared to step in there and try your hardest, that means you're going to train so hard to try and improve your game and make sure you come in there physically fit. So she's got that down. It's just a matter of working out some of those kinks in the game right now. And look, the women's bantamweight division isn't the deepest of divisions in the UFC at all. So there's definitely some fair competition in there for her, even, with her below average striking these days. But that fight just there, as you said, the hold my beer moment, there was two fights in a row where the skill level was kind of hard to watch. I'm going to say that. And again, I'm going to bring this up. I watched this with some friends who had rarely watched UFC before. I had to apologize for the level of quality. Like,
don't you hate that? Don't you hate convincing your friends to come out to a bar and spend 2 hours and say, no, listen, if you watch it, you'll like it, and then they disappoint you. They not being your friends, but the people you paid money allegedly to watch.
Yeah, it was... Let's start with Mackenzie Dern. So Mackenzie Dern, obviously one of the UFC's new prospects coming in. She's one of the very best in the world at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. She won the Worlds in 2016, I believe. And then she kind of disappeared off the scene in 2017 because she started to transition into MMA. She finally arrived in UFC, in the UFC. And I think it's maybe too early. I think she's here too early. She's got so much that she needs to work on. I think that she obviously is great on the mat, but man, she can't get anyone down there. Ashley Yoder came into this fight with 0% takedown defense. Like, I don't read too much into these stats because I think it's a little bit strange, but I think Mackenzie Dern really showed no awareness of how to get someone down to the mat when their back's against the cage. Obviously, when someone's wearing a gi in the middle of an open space, it's a whole different game. You've got to work on all these different entries, like imanari rolls and berimbolo or something. I don't know, something random. Brazilian jiu-jitsu stuff. It doesn't exist here, and Mackenzie Dern really struggled to get her down. When she did, she was outstanding. She did so much work in 2 minutes. It was absolutely incredible. And that final 2 minutes easily won her the fight because she was struggling up until then. I think she clearly lost round two, was losing round three until the takedown. And that first round was a lot closer than many people believe. Adelaide Bird scored the fight. Scored that round for Yoda. And I didn't have a problem with it, to be honest. I think Yoda was actually landing the harder and cleaner shots. What do you guys think about this overall? Because this is a big talking point coming out of this event.
We've always known that great Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioners don't automatically make good wrestlers. And here's more proof of that. And the thing is, it's counterintuitive because any MMA grappler will tell you, I pretend like I know that, like I grapple. I speak for everyone who actually does it and assume that your opinion lines up with mine. So taking someone down against the fence is easier usually than taking them down in open space. They can't maneuver their hips, you know, they can't sprawl you. It's physically taxing, but you'd think that she'd be able to do the easier one, you know?
Yeah, there's pros and cons of each. I know that Tyron Woodley is especially good at using the fence as a tripod. So he actually uses his two legs as the front two and uses the cage, and you really can't get him down when his back's on the cage. Ben Askren is also a master of that. These are two very good wrestlers, though, so I think that's the problem. You've got two very good wrestlers using the cage. Yeah, it's the thing about Mackenzie Dern, and let's compare it to someone who fought towards the end of the card, Brian Ortega. Brian Ortega is winning fights on his feet right now, and that makes people want to maybe shoot in to throw a takedown and get the fight to the mat. There's no reason for anyone to respect Mackenzie's doing stand-up, so that means it probably won't even get to the ground. I think there's a lot of work to be done here, and I think I don't know who she's going to be matched up against with next because it's going to be tough to find someone. I assume that the UFC will want to match her against someone where she can win.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what you have to do with the young prospect.
Can you imagine the dollars that Paige VanZant versus Mackenzie Dern would rack in, though? Like, that'd be an interesting fight. Like,
the comments on social media underneath those fights would be lewd.
Yeah,
I would ban comments underneath the promos for that fight.
Yeah, you can definitely tell which dudes on Twitter don't get any when they just it's like the freaks come out when Mackenzie Dern was fighting, but I mean, to a certain extent, but I think she showed glimpses of promise, you know, that maybe, you know, Katsingano wasn't showing in her performance. I thought the overhand in some scenarios was had a lot of success for her when she was landing on Yoder. And again, like you said, that 2 minutes that she had on the ground, the way she just crawled up on her back to get control like that, I mean, it was almost like it took me aback because you see her in this scenario on her feet and she's so out of place and you're thinking, oh, what's going on here? And then as soon as she gets on the ground, it's like, okay, I'm at home. And you see that difference there. It's just about getting those points of strength, you know, to match with the stand up. And then who knows, she could be the next Brian Ortega if she can get her stand up a little bit more in line. And I think she has power for the division too, because, you know, some of the shots that she were landing, if she could just be a little bit more accurate and not receive on the end of some of the punches that she was throwing, then maybe there could be more success and she could find that kind of, I mean, the fight coming into her UFC career was a knockout, so there was definitely some form of development there, but you know, she just needs time. I mean, she's still a very young prospect.
Yeah, she's 24 years old. I mean, we can objectively talk about her performance, but she's got nowhere to go but up, and she is going to.
Yeah,
like this cannot possibly be the ceiling for Mackenzie Dern.
Mm-hmm. 100% agreed.
Any other fights on the card catch your eye? There's one Savage knockout. I mean, is anyone gonna Anyone going to talk about
an Hernandez knockout?
Yeah,
because those two savage knockouts.
Did you hold on? Let's we'll get into Dalloway Lombard, but real quick with Alex Hernandez. When I'm watching this guy, I'm like, and I'm hearing the commentary. They're saying, "Oh, you know, he trains with TJ. He's trying to be the next TJ Dillashaw." First off, I was kind of upset at him for, you know, faking the touch gloves and then goes for a kick on all kinds. That's a Colby Covington move. I did not like that. And, you know, he kind of looks like him. I'm hoping he's not the next Colby at 155 because Kevin Lee will sort that shit out quick. But the knockout, let's talk about the finish because that was something. And I don't know, maybe the punch was perfect for sure. It was a great counter, hit him right on the nose. And just the way that Beneil Dariush was destabilized after that, it kind of reminded me of the way he fell over when Barbosa hit him. I mean, it was two really, really bad knockouts to take, and not in successive fashion because he did get a win in between that. But, man, that was definitely a wake-up call. And, you know, on the flip side, it was a great debut and a great way to get your foot in the door early and for Alex Hernandez. And I want to see him continue because – man, you know, he showed he was very crafty. His footwork was on point, and the aggression was also a really interesting. You know, he forced Beneil Dariush to hit him with something, and you could see that Dariush was maybe a little bit too overeager with some of the hooks that he was throwing, and in turn, you know, it left up positions for him to get tagged, and that's what he did. And I think it was all part of the plan, but. Yeah, it was definitely a good showing.
And it's kind of interesting because when we think of just a brick of a left hand, Dariush's trump card is that huge left, and he got beaten to it, plain and simple. That final exchange, they both threw a left, and Hernandez just got there first. So I thought that was just a touch of irony. I mean, best wishes to Dariush, but he got beaten in a contest of left hands. Didn't think that would happen.
Yeah.
I like Hernandez. I think he's going to be great. He looks great. But man, that start turned me off him a lot. So let's quickly touch on, before we wrap things up, the quick disqualification at the end of round one between Hector Lombard and CB Dalloway. Very interesting moment. I'm glad that the referees, this is my opinion, I am glad that the referee decided to disqualify Hector Lombard. Hector Lombard obviously answered back with a 1-2 combination after the horn. And CB Dalloway was out. He got stretched out of the octagon. So that's concerning. I'm glad that the referee got it right and disqualified him. I think finally we're starting to see some justice for some bad decisions. Because remember Jermaine Duranemi versus Holly Holm. Jermaine Duranemi did this twice.
Remember Jermaine.
It was not punished. Not even punished. Not even a point taken away, let alone disqualified.
And twice. Like, let's not forget.
Just goes to show that the impact of the strike is what makes all the difference, regardless of the action, which is a little bit bizarre.
Right. And there's no defense either. I remember Lombard was saying in his interview with MMA Fighting that, oh, he should have kept on fighting, that I've been in that situation before. But, I mean, come on. You hit him with a 1-2, threw him back. You want him to keep on fighting after getting concussed? Like, what? Where's the logic in that? There's no... You know what I'm saying? Again, you're a prize fighter, but to a certain extent, let's be serious here. And yeah, there's just no place for that. Again, if you've been in 40 plus pro fights, you know when to stop and you know how you have to react after you hear the bell or the horn, no matter if you're in the process of getting a submission or you're on the ground defending for your life. Like, there's a protocol and you have to follow it. And it definitely wasn't followed, and he got disqualified for it.
And I mean, even if we decide there wasn't bad intent behind it, like, people pointed out that CB threw a kick and Hector countered with that two punch combination once before. And so even if it was just muscle memory that he felt the kick and threw the two punch combination reflexively, it still happened after the bell. You know what I mean? Like, even if you couldn't control it, Hector can make the case that he's not a bad guy and it wasn't intentional, but the DQ was correct. You know, there's no argument against it.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of both sides here. You can see how it happened, and you can respect his side. But at the end of the day, it is an illegal strike, so he should be disqualified, and that's what happened. And I'm glad to see that. we're going to wrap things up because we're quickly approaching 1 hour and we have gone a little bit over time here, but we wanted to make sure we touched on all the main events coming out of UFC 222. The UFC is taking a break this week. We'll still be back later in the week to discuss maybe some of your questions. We might reach out and ask for some questions to touch on and spend a podcast answering questions from our fans. Until then, though, I'm Jade Nichols, and we're signing out from the Body Lock Podcast.
Real quick, shout out to Cody Stammen, because that was a big win over Brian Caraway.
As always, guys, glad to have you listening to us. Take care. See you next week.
Peace.